Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Let's say you're one of the thousands, if not millions, of Americans on a popular low-carb diet, a lunch of spray cheese, beef jerky sticks, and diet soda. It only sets you back 5 carbs. Better than a bowl of rice and vegetables, right? This week, the answer might be yes, and next week, the answer might be no. Joining us now is the founder of the Yale Prevention Research Center and author of the book Disease Proof. He joins us by phone from Connecticut. Welcome back to the show, Dr. David Katz.
Thank you, Ann. Pleasure to be with you.
You recently co-published a paper titled, Can We Say What Diet Is Best for Health? Why that question in the first place?
Well, I think it's obvious, and your intro, I think, hints at the reason why. The journal actually came to me. This is a journal that publishes peer-reviewed papers that review what we know. The name of the journal is Annual Review in Public Health, so it's important themes in public health. This is a huge theme in public health. There's no debating that food is the fuel that runs the human machine. It reverberates throughout every organ system. It has implications for both years in life and life in years. I think everybody agrees on that. So questions about what's good to eat are enormously important to public health, and one could, in fact, argue they're among the most important questions in modern public health where we suffer from obesity and diabetes. And just as you said, you know, we hear today, you know, we should be on the grapefruit diet, and tomorrow we should be on the no-fruit diet, and the next day we should be on the pickle juice diet, and, you know, on and on it goes. And frankly, we just keep fiddling while Rome burns. And in this case, the burning is the development of diabetes in as many as 1 in 3 Americans within a generation. We're staring down the barrel of that gun. This is serious business. So, you know, I was pleased when the journal said, look, you seem to be someone who looks at this from altitude. You've written textbooks on nutrition. You don't have a dog in the fight. You're not trying to, you know, sell a particular diet. Are you willing to review the literature dispassionately and reach a conclusion on this topic? And I said, if I may put it bluntly, hell yeah.
Did you reach a conclusion?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the issue is this. The basic theme of healthful eating is absolutely clear, incontrovertible in my opinion, and it's based on intervention studies, randomized trials, transcultural comparisons, studies spanning decades in every population around the world. And it's a diet, you know, as best we can get there, of real foods, mostly plants. If it glows in the dark, step away from the box and nobody will get hurt. And if you eat wholesome foods, and that would be vegetables, fruits, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, yes, I think whole grains are in the mix, and then with or without poultry, fish, seafood, lean meats, dairy, eggs, I mean, all of those things are more discretionary and they can be in or out. But all of the nutrients we debate all the time, sugar and salt and saturated fat and all of the nutrients in the superfoods, antioxidants, they all take care of themselves. You eat a wholesome diet, and by and large, the nutrients sort themselves out. But where the answer is no, and so, you know, can we say what diet is best for health? The basic theme, absolutely yes. The specific variant on the theme that's best, absolutely no. Can we say for sure that an optimal vegan diet is better for human health than an optimal Mediterranean diet? We can't. Can we say that either of those is better than an optimal paleo-style diet? We can't. Can we say that any of those is better than an optimal Asian diet or low-fat diet or, you know, on the list could go? No, as long as you stay on the reservation, stick to the theme, we can't answer those questions. I don't think we ever will be able to for the following reason. Definitive proof that an optimal vegan diet produces better lifelong health outcomes, say, than an optimal Mediterranean diet, would basically require randomly assigning neonates to one of those two dietary patterns and following them for the next 100 years. You know, I don't see that happening anytime soon. So, you know, when you look at the evidence we do have, it argues so eloquently for a basic theme of healthful eating. And here's my point, and thank you for this opportunity, because I will preach this every chance I get. Let's use what we know. As a preventive medicine specialist looking on at this unending My Diet Can Beat Your Diet beauty pageant and the unending parade of fad diet bestsellers, I think we're frittering away years of life and life in years debating what we don't know, debating the My Diet Can Beat Your Diet, you know, icing and ignoring the cake. We could act on what we do know and eliminate up to 80% of all chronic disease right now. Let's do that first and then debate the rest.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. David Katz, founder of the Yale Prevention Research Center and the author of the book Disease Proof. We're talking about an article he published or a paper he published recently in the Annual Review of in Public in Public Health or of Public Health. It's titled, Can We Say What Diet Is Best for Health? If you have a question or comment about your diet you'd like to run by Dr. Katz, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said that it's not really about things like vitamins and minerals and sugar and fat and that sort of a thing, but we do know sugar is a huge problem in our diet, and that's because we eat so much processed food.
Exactly.
And sugar is included in processed food, and you and I have talked about this before,
right,
to make it taste better if it doesn't have as much fat in it, or to make it taste bitter if it doesn't have as much sodium in it, or whatever.
Yeah, but more to it than that. And actually, the insidious part, Dan, is something called sensory-specific satiety. And actually, I have my latest column for U.S. News and World Report, people can find online, is on this topic. You know, everybody overeats at an all-you-can-eat buffet. I think everybody knows that. And so, you know, it's time to reorient, because where's the bargain? You know, you get fat at no extra charge and then can spend a fortune to lose the weight that you gain for free. So it's sort of time to wake up and smell the SlimFast, people. But the reason we overeat at an all-you-can-eat buffet is because variety is a goad to appetite. It's the way the human appetite center is hardwired. The PhDs working for the big food companies know this, and so they put sugar in pasta sauce. They put sugar in salty foods, even sometimes in chips, but certainly in crackers. And they do the converse. They put salt in things like breakfast cereal at very high levels, often more concentrated than it is in potato chips. All of that, whether you taste it or not, is acting on your hypothalamus and it making you eat more. So absolutely, I mean, we eat too much sugar, we eat too much salt. But if you eat more wholesome foods, not only does it cut out the sugar, cut out the salt, cut out the trans fat, cut down on the calories, it allows you to fill up on fewer calories, because you're taking away that influence of sort of, you know, an engineered aspect of food that stimulates us to eat more than we should. And we've heard about that from people like Michael Moss, who has his book out, Salt, Sugar, Fat, and wrote a New York Times Magazine cover story about the addictive properties of junk food. It's not by accident, it's by design. But if we eat the right kinds of foods, we can fight back.
And a lot of that goes to having to prepare the right kinds of foods. People don't seem as willing to do that as they used to. A lot of people don't even know how to cook.
Exactly right. So, and you mentioned kindly at the beginning my book, Disease Proof. Really, that's what the book is about. It's about skill power for getting there from here. I have it because I'm supposed to. This is my expertise. Everybody can get it. But we have to take health and weight control a bit more seriously. You know, I mean, basically, we don't expect to get rich quick. We expect to work and manage our money. We can work and manage our health. There is some effort involved, but the return on investment is huge. But I agree with you completely, Ann. The issue really is people don't know how to get there from here. We can address that, both individually and collectively. But we don't focus on addressing that until or unless we agree on where there is. So my very point is, as long as we keep debating, you know, this week we cut fat, next week we add back butter, the week after we cut out all grains because, you know, they're giving us dementia and making us fat. I mean, if we keep bopping around like a ping pong ball, we never agree on the destination. It may be hard to get where you want to go even after you all agree where you want to go. There's no way to get where you want to go until you agree where you want to go. And I'm saying we do know. We are not clueless about the basic care and feeding of Homo sapiens. The theme of healthful eating is clear. Let's embrace it. And then we can take on the challenge of all the things we need to do to get there from here.
The more we know about genetics, to what extent does that affect how much we know about how diet affects different people differently? I know there's some things I can't eat because it affects me.
Right.
I have a sensitivity to it. And doctors won't necessarily tell me that.
So two answers. First, three actually. First, it's quite important. We know that genes matter. Second, we're really in the age of epigenetics now. And so, you know, there was a thinking when we first fell in love with the genome that DNA was destiny. It's really not. To a far greater extent, dinner is destiny. The things we do that influence our health, our behavior, influence the expression of our very genes, can alter what our DNA does. And so really, behavior is much more destiny than DNA. And then the third answer is, I imagine, Anne, that there is significant genetic variation among koala bears. I haven't made a study of it, but, you know, no two koala bears are identical. But they're all koala bears. And, you know, we look at them and think, well, gee, that's important. Koala bears eat eucalyptus leaves because they're koala bears. Now, I would argue we are a species, too. The basic theme of healthful living for our species is what we have in common. And then the variations on that theme is where things like nutrigenomics come in. And absolutely, there are variations on the theme, which was the very finding in our paper. The theme of healthful eating is clear. The specific variant that's best is not clear. And that's a beautiful thing because it allows you to customize the theme to suit your genes, if you're so inclined and have the information, but minimally, your preferences. Because, you know, I think the sweet spot is loving food that loves us back. Getting pleasure from good food and pleasure from good health and having options gives us the best opportunity for that.
Pam in Clintonville, you're on the air with Dr. David Katz. Hi, Pam.
Good morning, Ann. Yes, I had a question for the doctor. We all know people that physically they don't have any particular major health issues, but yet when they try to cut down on their caloric intake, they simply can't lose weight. And you see that, you were talking about other species, you can see that in dogs. There are some dogs that require very few calories to maintain their weight, certain species of dogs. And I was wondering if there was any thought that there may be something similar genetically in humans that predispose them to have a much harder time to lose weight when they cut back on their caloric intake.
Well, thank you, Pam. Good question. The answer, and I know we're short on time, but absolutely yes. And actually, I have an online resource for that very reason. It's called the National Exchange for Weight Loss Resistance. So if you Google that, you'll find that it's an online forum. And just briefly, first of all, losing weight, gaining it back, that cycle tends to make people weight loss resistant because they tend to lose both fat and muscle and then gain back mostly fat. And as you diet and lose weight, the calories required to maintain your weight go down anyway, so people tend to struggle with weight loss. Some people are uniquely resistant to weight loss. To some extent, that may be genetics. To some extent, it may be other things we're really just beginning to learn about, like the intestinal bacteria. Variation in the microbiome has now been clearly linked to variation in the ease or difficulty with which weight is lost or gained. So we're really just starting to learn about some of those interesting reasons. But still, most people underestimate their calorie intake, overestimate their exercise, and by and large, if we get those things right, if we eat well and control our calorie intake and we're active, most of us will wind up with much better weight. Some of us may still struggle a bit, but you know, the whole population bell curve will move to a better place.
Pam, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. David Katz, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ann. A pleasure.
Dr. David Katz, he's founder of the Yale Prevention Research Center and author of the book Disease Proof. We'll continue with Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Mealtime can be a noisy affair, especially if you're part of a big family like I was, but for some, even when they're alone, breakfast and dinner include a troubling cacophony.
You are so fat, stupid idiot. Oh, come on.
That's what an eating disorder sounds like, according to my guest. She's the CEO of the Center for Balanced Living in Columbus, which works with people who have eating disorders. Dr. Laura Hill, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ann.
We talked about this the last time. You tried to describe it to me, and I really appreciate being able to hear what you're talking about, mm-hmm. too, now, because I wasn't sure what to expect. But they're actually voices.
It's a chaos of noise. And as we have been exploring what that noise sounds like, what has been so wonderful is once we've been able to identify it within the brain and the responses of the brain, we've taken that back to the clients at our research site at UC San Diego and at the Center for Balanced Living in Columbus. And the clients have just been amazing in saying, yes, it's very hard. It's not like a schizophrenic, very clear conversation. It is a lot of chaotic noise and trying to tease out what that noise might sound like. But when we started putting all the noise together, they said, that's it.
And that has to mean a lot to you, knowing that so many people are responding to the same thing.
That's right. And it can have, you know, a different emphasis. Sometimes I've probably developed 10, 20 different recordings, as the clients will say. You know, the emphasis is always around like the recording that you played. But then there may be other times that it's a huge amount of self-doubt and self-blame. And it may be from every bite they're eating or not trusting the decisions they're making. And binge eaters will have an equal amount of noise, but theirs is often about continuing to eat.
We could talk about this all the time. There's so much to talk about. Mm-hmm. But specifically, the reason that occurred to me to have you in today was because there's a lot of really exciting news at the center. For one thing, you've tripled in size.
Yes,
tell
we
us
have.
About where you've moved to and why the tripling and what you're doing now.
As the need continues to rise, as our society continues to focus and into extreme diets and developing unrealistic body sizes and shapes. But as eating disorders take rise in our society, we estimate that there's about 118,000 persons with eating disorders in Central Ohio, and that would be
118,000
with anorexia, bulimia nervosa, or binge eating disorders, or some other variations of that, and that includes people of all ages. You know, it's very easy to think that eating disorders are just among adolescents. The average age at the center is 37, and it's because eating disorders truly do reach throughout all ages. But the reason we've been growing is because more people are daring to step forward and seek help, and because eating disorders are so severe, and they have the highest death rate of any mental illness, if you can believe it, even more than schizophrenia. So due to that, and because people are somewhat more aware of it, everybody kind of knows about eating disorders, but no one really knows what eating disorders are about. So more people are stepping up to the plate and say, we need to have assessments done. We need to have our loved one, whether it's my wife or my daughter or whomever is coming, if it's my son. And we have moved into developing much more specific, very evidence-based on our research, treatments that are addressing towards the anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating.
When you're talking about 118,000 people, are you talking about extreme cases, people where it's affecting their well-being? Because just like anything, you could have a mild case of this or a mild case of that, right?
Yes. I'm saying that it's within a diagnostic level. So it's if it's a subclinical level, everybody experiences disordered eating on Halloween or Thanksgiving or whatever.
It's not your last Snickers
you
bar, people. Right. Okay.
But and that's just part of life. But what we have always done, Anne, that has been so interesting to me is, you know, my first case was in 1979 to treat an eating disorder case, and we didn't even have a diagnosis then. A diagnosis didn't even come out until 1980. But we have always, since 1980, looked at eating disorders from the outside in. So if you had diabetes, and you were talking about that earlier, diabetes. And so with diabetes, a person, we know that the pancreas is not working and the insulin is not being produced. And if the body does not produce enough insulin, the food cannot enter the cells. So we know diabetes is primarily a biologically based illness with social impact. We have always looked at eating disorders as a psychosocial illness that ends up with some biological imbalances. In 2006, just as recently as that, we began to realize when fMRIs became so much more detailed.
Which, magnetic resonance imaging.
Yes.
Of the brain.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's an MRI, like a 3D image, and we can see them in enough detail that you can take an MRI on any level of the body or any part of the body, but an MRI of the brain. And when we make it F, that becomes functional magnetic resonance imaging. And so you take that functional task and we watch what happens. So if somebody who doesn't have an eating disorder goes into an MRI machine and they may have a straw and have them drink a milkshake, and then we watch Dr. K, Walter K at the UC San Diego and his research team would watch what pathways and where in the brain is responding to the food response. And maybe that milkshake would translate into, oh, I'm hungry, I think I'll drink some. Oh, that gave me pleasure. The brain is responding, yes, I'll drink a little more. The brain is responding to the sensation of hunger and processing that with another thought to drink some more. What we found in Walt's research is that when a person with anorexia drinks that milkshake and it has a full-blown diagnosis of anorexia, there is no signaling in the brain of hunger or fullness, so they don't even know if they should drink the milkshake. They get no sense in the anterior insula, no response at times at all of the taste, or just a small amount.
Meaning no pleasure then.
And the pleasure is next door at the nucleus accumbens and no firing of pleasure. And then when the thoughts are trying to translate, wait a minute, should I even be drinking this? Should I not be drinking this? It tastes like cardboard to me and I'm getting no pleasure from it. Then the thoughts move into the chaotic thoughts that you just played earlier, saying, oh my gosh, I shouldn't be drinking this, because in essence, a person with anorexia is eating blind. They have no sense if they should eat it. They can't tell. And then a part of the brain called the parietal is so disturbed in its response that it makes the person experience themselves as getting fatter by the moment. And there come the fat thoughts.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Laura Hill. She's CEO of the Center for Balanced Living. We're talking about eating disorders right now. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What do we know at this point? It's been about 9 years since this was discovered. What do we know about what comes first, the chicken or the egg? In other words, is the behavior, because we know the brain is changeable now.
Constantly.
Which we didn't know 10 or 15 years ago.
Right.
Even. So we know the brain is changeable. So we know that this could be the manifestation of behavior, or is the behavior manifested by the brain?
Well, it's going to be depending on which researcher you're going to talk with.
Okay.
But what appears and where I'm looking at it with researchers is it appears that a person inherits certain traits, and that those traits make one vulnerable to developing the illness, just as one may be vulnerable to developing diabetes genetically, or one can be vulnerable. Only it's not one trait, it's polygenetic. There are multiple traits, and we haven't identified them all, but we're on the track to do so. And in some ways, the way I think about it, it's like a Venus flytrap, you know. And when in school, when you saw those plants that had kind of teeth to it, and it sits open, and the fly lands on the leaf or the petal of the Venus flytrap and starts walking in, and then the farther in it goes, the Venus flytrap literally closes and catches the fly. What I would say is what we are learning in research is the fly landing on that Venus flytrap. Each teeth of the flytrap is like a trait. So it's holding it in. And the more the child or the adult starts dieting below and going in farther and getting more involved in that diet, if the person is of the trait and the species of a Venus flytrap where those teeth might be vulnerable, and once the diet goes to a severe level, the body literally, we have observed traits to literally the gene clicks on and it literally closes in and embraces, and the brain literally starts recalibrating itself to respond and think and feel and sense. It closes down certain sensations, it opens up others, and others become chaotic. And to get out would be almost as difficult as a fly trying to get out. If you only had a couple of the teeth, you might be able to get out. If you had none of those traits, you could diet and walk away, diet, and what's the big deal? But those who are vulnerable, once it stops, we can't, they're locked in, but it's not impossible. And so we're finding that the younger the child and the sooner they're brought in, the more we can pry those petals back open and we can free them from that illness, and the brain wires on and works around those traits that could be used productively instead of destructively. If they're an adult, it takes a lot more support, and that's where our new research has been coming in.
Ann in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Hi, Ann.
Hi there, Ann, a longtime WOSU supporter and advocate of your show. Love it.
Thank you.
My question for you, guest, is this. Whether or not her estimate of 118,000 people in Central Ohio with eating disorders, whether that includes those who are clinically obese or whether it does not, and if not, why not?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. It would include those who have binge eating disorder, and those who have binge eating disorder are usually clinically obese, meaning they have a body mass index of 30 or above. But the national statistic is about 10% of persons 16 and above have some form of diagnosable eating disorder in the United States. And the statistic of Central Ohio would be 10% of your persons 16 above. And that's how that statistic was evolved
and
established.
That category includes
binge eating disorder and therefore obesity. But obesity will be a lot more people than those who have binge eating disorder. There are more people who are obese that don't have a full eating disorder.
Gotcha.
So it would be a subpart of those who are obese.
Ann, thanks a lot for that call. Jody in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jody.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy I stumbled onto this program. We have a 16-year-old daughter who has had a host of diagnoses over the last several years, starting with anorexia at about age 12 or 13. We were able to get her into a short-term residential treatment center, but long story short, she most recently has been diagnosed with high-functioning Asperger's mm-hmm. on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. And they've always said that her eating disorder did not present in a typical way mm-hmm. and that it was likely, as we've discovered recently, likely related to her Asperger's issues and mm-hmm. sensitivity and touch and texture. I'm wondering if there is any recent development in treatment for people who are on the autism spectrum that have eating disorders.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so if you could comment on that, please.
Yeah, thank you, Jody.
Oh, it's a wonderful question. And the answer are explorations of that. There have been studies for years now looking at the Asperger syndrome and how it may impact anorexia. And if your daughter is diagnosed, in some ways it's like the two circles and the two diagnoses overlapping one another. And she may have a sense of feeling more isolated or not just be more restricted in her emotional expression, holds back and therefore doesn't eat. So she can have, and it's not that uncommon to have both diagnoses and one kind of partnering with the other. And there is treatment that what often has to happen is that she needs more concrete, not open-ended questions, but maybe even more multiple-choice questions in helping to guide and direct and offer her support. If she has the anorexia side, she may not know what to be eating because she may not even feel the hunger. So she needs her dietitian, and I will then let you know that Nationwide Children's has just opened in January of this year an eating disorder program at the partial hospital intensive and outpatient level. And Dr. Christian Parisot is the director of that, medical director of that program. And he brings to that program, he was just hired this summer, a real family base on how to help structure and collaborate and help provide your daughter some structure so she can head to school and know that she's eating what she needs to eat while she may feel some isolation due to the Asperger side. So there is hope, and what we're realizing, our treatments have been potentially too open-ended in the past, and our clients need much more structure.
Jody, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. Another real quick one from Paul. Hi, Paul. We're running out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in.
Oh, well, thank you very much. This is Paul Grinnello. Hi, Laura.
Oh, my goodness. Hello, Paul. nice to hear you.
Something to get out on the air, and maybe you could comment, is the receptiveness of insurance companies to pay for people to have adequate length of stay in partial or inpatient care. And I'll just throw that topic out there. And with all the research and everything you're talking about, I just wondered where we're at with that.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
It's nice to hear you, Paul, and you've opened a new can of worms that's going to result in Anne having to have probably a series of interviews for this.
Yeah, we don't have enough time for a new can of worms, but see what you can.
But the result is, yes, Paul, the new research is showing that as we are restoring, whether it's binge eating and bringing body to a stronger, more lower level body mass, and to anorexia, restoring it to a higher, we are finding major brain responses and reactions. And just as the body starts to get close on a body weight, we thought body weight was the ultimate goal in the past. And now we're realizing that the normalizing the body weight results in major neurochemical imbalance, so much so that serotonin, for example, goes 50% higher as the person starts stabilizing, resulting in the noise getting even higher and worse. So we need the clients to stay in treatment over that hump, and that's when the insurance companies want to send them home because they've stabilized in their weight. And so it is major education time, and I am meeting with many of them, and we're trying to get the word out. And but insurance companies are, let's say, on the best of moments on this day, have a lot to learn as we are trying to explore this illness.
Paul, thanks for that call. You know what, Laura Hill, we really need to just sit down for a whole hour and talk. It's always fascinating to talk with you about this, and so important to the public. So I hope you'll come back again real
soon. I'd be glad to. Thank you, Anne.
That's Laura Hill. She's CEO of the Center for Balanced Living. We'll have a link to their site on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Give them a low-down beat, and they begin dancing. I've got those 10 little tapping toes.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Hope your feet are happy. If they're not, you might be interested in our next segment. As the weather warms, many central Ohioans are starting to exercise outside. Outdoor activity is great for the heart and soul, but not necessarily the feet. Podiatrists typically see an increase in foot and ankle injuries about this time of year. Joining us now by phone is a podiatrist with Foot and Ankle Specialists of Marysville, Dr. Carly Robbins. Welcome to the show, Dr. Robbins.
Thank you so much for having me, Anne.
What are some common injuries you see this time of year as people are getting outside more?
We definitely see an increase in injuries because of a few things. One is inconsistency outside with uneven ground. So we'll see ankle sprains and strains. We also see, especially in Ohio in the winter months, that people are not necessarily as active. And so when they, when the weather gets nicer, they want to go out, run, play sports, and they haven't necessarily conditioned or stretched properly, we'll definitely see tendonitis, which is inflammation of the tendons, stress fractures, heel pain or plantar fasciitis, and other things like that.
When you say heel pain or plantar fasciitis, is that the same thing?
I say plantar fasciitis and heel pain together because I would say typically when we see people with heel pain, it is plantar fasciitis in the young, active, healthy group. However, you can have heel pain for lots of other reasons. But typically, you know, this time of year, you haven't been exercising a while, you go out, throw on a new pair of shoes and try to run. If you're having heel pain, it would be either a stress fracture or plantar fasciitis.
Another thing we do is we maybe whip on it if people who haven't been working out for a while and decide to start a new regimen, you know, maybe it's, you know, at the beginning of the year or right about now when the weather changes, they're going to get out and start doing something, and they maybe whip on an old pair of tennis shoes or they whip on a new pair and they may not be the right fit.
Correct. You know, and we see both sides. One, people are buying new shoes. They're not breaking into them properly before they start an exercise, or especially with running, you really want to get a new pair of shoes every 6 to 8 months, or about 600 to 800 miles. And another thing we see with shoes, if you're doing a certain specific sport at least 2 to 3 times a week, you should probably get a sport-specific shoe. You know, I grew up calling everything tennis shoes.
Yeah, I know. I just still do, but yeah.
Yeah. but there are shoes that are specific to tennis. There are shoes that are better for running. Nowadays, shoe companies have these sport-specific shoes. And again, if you're going to play a sport or be running, you should look for that type of shoe.
What does a cross trainer do? What are those kind of shoes for?
That, if you're going to get one shoe that you really want to use for lots of different activities, the cross trainer would be it, because it will have some of the support and cushion that you need for running, but it will also have other aspects to it. If you're, you know, if you're walking, if you're playing other sports, if you're dabbling in other sports and things, it's more of an overall general shoe. Whereas, you know, if you get a running shoe and you're playing tennis, it's not necessarily going to have the support you need for running from side to side.
How are we treating our feet in general, do you think?
Well, I would say overall, shoes have become more of fashion and less function as far as, and I'm totally generalizing here, but for women. And this goes beyond sports, obviously. If you take a piece of paper and you trace your foot, and then you actually look at your shoe compared to that tracing, they will typically look significantly different. Women's shoes are much narrower than our feet. They can be pointy. They can cause irritation. You know, we tend to wear heels and things that put a significant amount of pressure on the front of our foot, which can aggravate different conditions and things. So overall, I wouldn't say we're the kindest to our feet. But we're improving. There's more of an emphasis on women's shoes that are more comfortable. You can buy them easier, especially online, in different widths. So hopefully we're getting away from that a little bit.
Where do you fall on the barefoot running issue, minimal cushioning shoes, what shoes, you know, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Definitely a little controversial. I would say personally where I fall is probably toward more support. However, and I've actually seen a lot less people come in asking about this and with injuries, and that's because when it first came out and it was very popular, people were not stretching, they were not conditioning, they were not weaning into it slowly. They were just putting these shoes on, or even socks sometimes. They were essentially like socks with a little rubber, and just going out there and running on unnatural surfaces. And we were seeing stress fractures, tendonitis, you know, lots of other injuries. Now, if you have no structural problems with your feet, you're having no pain, you're an avid runner, and you want to wean into that slowly, you know, and train your feet, then people do it and have no problems and love it. But typically what the doctors see is when it goes bad and people are not doing it properly.
I would imagine that traditionally feet are something that people don't think about in terms of stretching.
They don't. They kind of ignore them. Although I will say, once you start having foot pain or ankle pain, then because you think about it with every single step, then, you know, then people pay a little bit more attention. But if we can start doing the stretches before we run, before we play sports, and even after, to prevent those injuries, then people would be a lot better off. And, you know, there are ways that you can actually stretch your feet while you're stretching other muscles in your leg. One of those ways, you know, are very simple. If you do stretches for the front and the back of your lower leg by just lifting your toes towards your nose or towards the floor, you'll actually feel a stretch in your foot as well.
So tell me, is this you laying on your back doing this, or?
You can do it laying on your back. You can just, you can actually do it in bed in the morning, you know, if you wanted to. But can do this sitting down with your legs outstretched. There's lots of different, there's ways that you can strengthen your feet and the muscles in your feet by trying to grab a towel with your toes is another easy one that you can try.
What does it matter if you're, say, flat-footed or have a high arch?
There, you know, I always tell patients, it doesn't matter what your foot looks like. It matters how it feels. And we see conditions with flat feet, with high arches, with everyone. So if you have a high arch or a really high arch or a really low arch and you're having pain, then, you know, we look at ways to prevent abnormal motion. You know, the only way to completely change the structure of your foot is for surgery. But a lot of people, if they're not having a lot of pain, we can try conservative things and they do really well. So, you know, people with flat feet, we're not going to give you an arch per se, but we're going to prevent your arch from flattening more. And sometimes that's enough to prevent pain and enable people to do the activities and things that they want to do. So, you know, some people ask all the time about orthotics or arch supports, and that's a great way to kind of doctor up unsupportive shoes so that people can walk with the way that their feet normally are and, you know, function without pain.
People who are generally fit, and I'm not necessarily talking about athletes, but just people who are fit, have been regularly working out, exercising, whether it's walking or whatever, do their feet reflect that? Are their feet generally in better shape, or is that not necessarily the case? Feet are different than the rest of the body.
Yes and no. Yes, they're different. As far as being fit, I would say people who are more active and run and play sports and exercise will typically have better balance and strength in their tendons and things. I often have people, besides stretching, do something that's called proprioception exercises. And essentially, it's strengthening and balancing and reteaching your, especially people with ankle instability who tend to sprain their ankles a lot. And it retrains and strengthens the tendons and ligaments and muscles on, you know, the inside, outside of your ankles and your feet to limit your exposure to injury. Because if you have that strength and that balance, then your body can essentially stop you from doing some of those things and injuring you. So in that sense, yes, those people typically tend to have more strength and balance. But as far as we talk about that with the rest of the body, I suppose the feet are a little bit different.
Patrick in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, doctor. Obviously, your remarks are striking home since I've got a boot on my foot at the moment. Going forward, the fact that I now had this stress fracture, the first one in my life, am I now going to be more... Is it more likely that I will have them in the future? And what should I be doing to avoid this uncomfortable boot in the future?
But it's so stylish.
Yeah.
Well, anytime you have a stress fracture, yes, you are at risk for refracturing that area because the bone is not as strong. But are you going to get stress fractures of other areas? You may not. So stress fractures typically happen for one of two reasons. Either your bone is not strong enough, and if that is the case, then yes, you may be at risk. One test that your doctor can perform is a bone density test, and that gives us a better idea if you need to strengthen those bones. The other reason would be you have totally normal bones, but you have an abnormal pressure and abnormal activity. So starting running and right off the bat, at 10 miles, yes, you can get a stress fracture. So depending on which one, I know that doesn't totally answer your question, but if it's the abnormal pressure and abnormal activity, if you gradually train, stretch, and wean into an activity, then, you know, hopefully you'll be absolutely fine and you won't have it. If it's because of your bone density, then that's something that you can work on with your doctor to decrease your risk. But going forward, I think you've learned your lesson here, and you'll definitely be a little bit more cautious. But again, I'm not sure in your circumstance which is the case. But hopefully you won't have to wear that boot for much longer.
Good luck with that, Patrick. Just real quickly, we're running out of time, but I wanted to address the issue of diabetes. Foot care is especially important for folks with diabetes. What can they do?
Absolutely. Diabetics, I tell every patient that I have with diabetes to inspect their feet every day to make sure that there's no red spots, no sores, no blisters, anything like that. And if there is, they absolutely need to call either their primary care doctor or their podiatrist right away. I have a lot of diabetic patients who have no issues. We see them on a regular basis, check them out, make sure that there's nothing going on. But it's typically when diabetics develop what's called neuropathy, mm-hmm. or the loss of feeling in their feet, is when they get into trouble. Because if you or I are wearing an uncomfortable pair of shoes or we step on something, we feel it and then we take them off. If they have something rubbing their feet, they can't necessarily feel it, and it can lead to an ulcer or sore and infection. I also tell my diabetics to shake their shoes out every morning because I've had a few patients with sores because their keys fell on their shoe and they had no idea.
Oh, wow. Sheesh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe more on that another time. But Dr. Carly Robbins, I want to thank you today for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Everybody out there, take care of your feet. That's Dr. Carly Robbins. She's a podiatrist in Marysville. Thanks for listening today. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.